Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast, joined as often by Danny LaRue to discuss further revelations about that Blake Griffin incident that surfaced late last night when we recorded.
And the incredibly uncertain timetable.
Yeah, I don't think it's that uncertain. I mean, most broken hands, 4 to 6 weeks is what I was expecting. That's what they always seem to be. Doc Rivers did say, though, in his remarks today that he thought it might be longer. Odd, as you noted, because a statement with his name on it just said it would be 4 to 6 weeks just before that. So maybe a little PR disconnect there. But more importantly, do you just have any thoughts on this, just overall what it could mean for the Clippers, a potential suspension for Blake, any of that stuff?
Well, it's certainly not a good thing. I think Kevin Pelton wrote a nice piece for ESPN, I believe it's an insider piece, about kind of the idea of whether the Clippers are better without him, which I agree, they have played better, but as he said in the piece, you know, there's a lot of context that matters in that. But the point that he was getting at in that, which I think is very astute here, is that it makes them very, very, they're in a precarious position when it comes to injuries because, you know, they lost when DeAndre was out. Chris Paul, of course, now has shoulders an inordinate amount of the playmaking load. So they can do some things without him because they have guys who can pick up the slack, but now they have to stay healthy.
Yeah, that's quite true, and we'll get to a few more of those issues that we talk about their victory over Indiana tonight. To me, the interesting question now is, what is the suspension going to be if there is one? And people are assuming that there's going to be one. There's been this sort of pregnant discussion that there could be some action. The NBA also is involved. The NBA could potentially suspend him, in which case the Clippers would not be able to provide any further action themselves. There's also the question of, is the suspension going to wait until he gets back? If it's a team-issued suspension, could it just be something without pay while he's injured anyway? Are they going to also make him miss games? A lot of this is really interesting. There isn't really a precedent for this that I recall. You know, there was the Tony Allen incident where he punched O.J. Mayo on the plane over a gambling debt, and O.J. Mayo was getting mouthy with him, according to reports. There actually was not a suspension for that. Ultimately, that was back in 2011. There have been some other suspensions for altercations with teammates, but I don't recall this ever happening with a staffer before, do you?
I can't think of a time, and to me, that's a bigger issue just because of the idea of just the difference between the two. You know, I think of a separation, you know, it's kind of, maybe they're not even management because it's not like it was like like an associate head coach or the head coach or something like that. But if we're dealing in a world where Rajon Rondo got a one-game suspension for saying something, of course, horrible to Kennedy, but I mean, if that suspension worthy, even with precedent and all that kind of stuff, breaking your hand by hitting somebody who is an employee of your team, I think is suspension worthy.
Yeah, there are some more complicating factors. We don't know what the employee, the equipment manager for the Clippers, whose name escapes me at the moment, but someone who ostensibly is very good friends with Blake, and they've even vacationed together before. And Blake sent out a tweet saying, you know, he felt really bad about it, and you know, as someone who's a close friend and he let things get out of control or something, is apparently occurred at a restaurant. And then the altercation continued outside is all that we really seem to know at the moment. So, and I mean, I think, you know, another thing, what did Matt Barnes get suspended for? He got suspended for like a game for like going back after Derek Fisher's. I can't remember, it was one or two games. The question will be then, because this was a staff person, is there more to it because it's someone who's kind of like below him in the hierarchy? But also maybe it's worthwhile that they were just at dinner, I think, kind of as friends. It wasn't like, you know, the guy was doing his job at the time. It's in the locker room. Hey, you didn't give me my socks fast enough. Now I'm going to punch you. It seemed like it was kind of more of an interpersonal thing. A lot of really interesting dynamics here, and maybe we can't fully pass judgment until more details of the altercation emerge.
I think that would be the responsible thing to do.
rather than speculating wildly?
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, well, let's speculate wildly. How many games do you think he gets?
One, maybe two.
And that after he returns from injury?
Correct.
Or is it just going to be And you think the NBA does it or the team does
it? I think the NBA does. I think the NBA does it.
Yeah, if the NBA is involved in the investigation, you would have to imagine that they would kind of be the ones to take this over. I think it's going to be 5 games.
Wow. And do you think he'll serve it while he's hurt, or do you think he'll serve it?
Well, technically, you can't serve it while you're hurt, although certainly teams have been known to fudge with that. The most salient example for me that comes to mind was Larry Sanders. I think at the end of the 2013-14 season, had the eye injury, the Bucks were tanking, he was out for the year, and then all of a sudden he was healthy enough to play the last 5 games of the year. They activated him, and then he served his 5-game suspension, so he was clean for the next year. So there's definitely room for fudging on something like that, especially with something like a broken hand. So I don't know. Maybe 5 games is over much, and I reserve the right to change my prediction when we find out what it is. Anything that you could think of on the court now for what this means for the Clippers?
Well, we get to see a larger sample of what it looks like when they have an actual floor spacer power forward, which is something that I've wanted to see, just how the Paul DeAndre pick and rolls work with that. They don't have the greatest forward talent, you know, outside of Blake Griffin, which is part of what has necessitated a lot of the issues they've had. They also just traded away Josh Smith. But I'm still interested to see if they can kind of cobble something together here that gives us a piece of information about how this team can function without him.
To me, the biggest thing is I think they can stay afloat okay, but this Pacers game was an example, as we'll get to. DeAndre Jordan played the entire second half in that game, and he's going to have to play a bazillion minutes. Cole Aldrich didn't play at all. He got killed by Miles Turner in the first half. You know, they have a lot of bench guys who can be exposed in larger roles. Chris Paul is going to have to play a ton of minutes. I mean, they still have three really, really good players on this team, J.J. Redick being the other, but then it drops off pretty quickly, and they're going to have to kind of get to some junk lineups. They're going to have to play Pierce more minutes maybe than they would have wanted to, and I don't know. Maybe they go absolutely crazy and they think, hey, we don't need Blake, and now we can trade him. And there's also sort of the issue that Blake can be a free agent in less than a year and a half. And if you're the team and you're doing the suspension, I think that's part of why I bet it's better for the team if the NBA does it, so that there can be a little bit less ill will there. But all of this has got to leave a really bitter taste in everyone's mouth, even the companies that Blake Griffin endorses, for that matter.
For sure.
So it's just another thing that makes you think that, you know, this is not... Teams that are on their way to a championship, like, don't have these kind of incidents, you know, and there's, I think, more and more smoke with the fire being this idea that the Clippers are not mentally tough, that they, you know, are sort of just like not championship material, not something that I've necessarily bought into, because they've had some wonderful clutch wins in the playoffs, just as they've had losses. But when you throw in their reputation for carping to the refs and stuff, it seems like they just always make it much harder on themselves than they need it to be. And it's already really hard in a Western Conference that has always been awesome, at least at the top, while they've been a contender.
One of the interesting things that I heard on TV today, I don't generally try to watch much of the chatter, but somebody attributed a quote to Blake Griffin from earlier in the season talking about the Warriors, that he noted how it was impressive that they basically had no kind of issues, that they, you know, the off-the-court stuff and all that. It's like, yeah, it would be nice to have that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, and that's, you know, it's funny. I mean, you never would have thought of Blake as, you know, not a high-character guy. But he had that incident with the cell phone, which he was exonerated for in Vegas, where he, you know, was reputed to have assaulted some guy who was taking a photo of him and gotten mad. So maybe, you know, he does have more of a temper, apparently, than people might have thought. Anyway, that's enough on this. We're probably getting into speculation a little bit too much. A couple smaller news items before we get into the other big news of the day. Enes Kanter had this Turkish agent who had no other clients. His name was Max Ergel. And actually, by all accounts, I mean, Max Ergel did a pretty darn good job. He got him to the Thunder and then got him a max contract. And now Kanter, for some reason, is leaving Max Ergel after, I think, you know, granted, he doesn't have like the greatest pull in NBA agent circles, but he also did an amazing job for him in getting him a max contract that he didn't deserve. But that's interesting. It'll be interesting to see where Kanter ends up from agent perspective. Also, this is a couple days old, but and may inform a little bit more about the Josh Smith trade. Donatus Muddy-Unis is improving, but he hasn't really even started running yet as of a couple days ago. So really, that's been about a month now that Demo has been shut down, just doing rehab stuff. So it's starting to become less and less likely that he's going to make an impact this year.
I'm excited to see Josh Smith play a role in the Clippers-Rockets 4-5 series.
All right, so the other big news of the day was the draw for the Olympic qualifying tournament. This is international basketball. For listeners who haven't listened in a while, I actually love international basketball. I did a whole series of podcasts on Eurobasket, and certainly during the Olympics, we will be going full force with some game wrap-ups. I love USA basketball. It's one of my favorite topics, and we did a podcast on what we thought the roster should be about a week ago. So this format has, before we get into what team is in what, this format has a few flaws in it, doesn't it?
It has a few flaws. The biggest one to me is actually not the format, like the structure of it, though I don't like that. It's the timing. And so this year, the FIBA qualifying, the Olympic qualifying tournament is July 4th to July 10th. And if you think about, if those, that date kind of rings alarm bells in your head, the reason for that is it is during the July moratorium, which means that even if a player has agreed to terms with a team, they cannot sign a contract. So players who are free agents, which when we go through some of the teams will be a lot of notable players, will be in a complicated circumstance, whether they've agreed to a contract or not, because in terms of things like getting insurance and everything like that, which could either lead to, you know, like lower quality play or just some players not being able to participate.
It's tough for FIBA, though, because a lot of these seasons basically end in June. The finals usually end around June 20th or so. The Olympics start on August 5th. So really, it's kind of like, when else are you going to have it? Or except around that time, and you got to have it after enough after the end of the season so that you can at least have some modicum of a training camp, and then you got to have a little bit of time before the Olympics as well. So I don't know what could have necessarily been done with that. My bigger problem with the format is that there are actually three separate tournaments from which only one team will advance from each one. There are 18 teams, six in each one. And so, of course, as is always the case in these FIBA tournaments, the teams are not evenly distributed among the qualifiers. And it would really be much more fair if it were just an 18-team tournament where you had the best three teams advancing out of it. But now the draw is highly uneven, and Serbia is really the biggest beneficiary.
Yeah, so Serbia, we'll do the group. So the Belgrade groupings, the 16.
Playing at home, first of all.
Playing at home.
And what's the best team we shouldn't say the groups because there's a group A and B within each tournament. But, the first tournament is in Belgrade. And what do you think is the best other team besides Serbia in that?
Probably Czech Republic, maybe Latvia.
Yeah, maybe Puerto Rico if they have all their guys. I mean, there's not Japan is in there.
Angola.
Angola. I mean, none of those teams are.
Well, let's rattle off the six just to make sure.
Shocking.
So it's Angola, Puerto Rico, host Serbia, Czech Republic, Japan, and Latvia. Hopefully, including Kristaps Porzingis.
Oh yeah, I mean, if Kristaps plays, maybe that could make things a little more interesting because Latvia actually had they're in a really terrible group at Eurobasket, but they actually overperformed a little bit. And then the Monster tournament is in Manila, which is going to be an unbelievable atmosphere for the Philippines, where a lot of people don't realize this, but they absolutely love basketball in the Philippines. They were second place in FIBA Asia, so they're going to be hosting it. And I think the reason why, of course, that they are splitting these tournaments among three places is to just make more money, you know, and that the teams that are hosting it were the ones who could say, oh, yeah, you know, people are actually going to show up. We're going to make some money. That helps. But, the Philippines, New Zealand, Senegal, neither of those, none of them are going to make it out of this group. But then you've got France, third place in Eurobasket, did not automatically qualify. They obviously have an awesome team. Canada, really disappointing loss as well, got third place in FIBA Americas. They're going to have all their guys, I would assume. And then Turkey as well got a wild card entry in there. I mean, why they couldn't have just put Turkey as the wild card in the Serbia group instead of Latvia, I have no idea, like, why you couldn't at least spread that out. But that's going to be a really interesting one with a lot of NBA guys in it, and I'm looking forward to watching that one quite a bit. Who do you like out of that group?
depending on who plays for France, I think they have a ton of really good talent. I mean, you think about how somebody like Evan Fournier has really blossomed. Batum, I really love as an international player if he can really get it going. But we'll have to see who actually plays.
Gobert says he wants to play, although he's going to be coming off this MCL injury. But and I mean, I think for a lot of these guys too, with this being, you know, 2 weeks after the finals could potentially end. You know, if the Spurs make the finals, is Tony Parker going to play? You know, you got those sorts of considerations as well. The last tournament is in Turin, Italy. Italy was the way this worked was the teams that hosted basically got a free invite in. I think Philippines and yeah, actually Serbia, I don't think would have made this necessary. Oh no, they would.
Yeah, they would. If they were fourth in Eurobasket.
Yeah. So it's Italy. And actually Italy would have made it too. I think it was third through sixth got automatic bids in here because Croatia is the wild card. But this is going to be an awesome tournament too. Your Italy will be playing at home. You got Croatia as the wild card, and you have Greece. And I also wouldn't even count out Mexico, who always seems to punch above their weight in these tournaments. And then you got Tunisia and Iran, who will not be threats.
Yeah, this will be a fun one. I think this will be maybe the most entertaining games, maybe not the best played of these groups. I think the Manila group will definitely have the best teams, but like a Croatia-Italy game could just be fantastic.
Yeah, and I think I like Greece the most of this group because I think they're the only team that really can defend that well. I was disappointed that they went out in Eurobasket as early as they did. I thought that they would maybe have a little bit better of a run, especially if Giannis is going to play. He's really the one guy that can match up with Gallo for Italy. So I would expect it to be Italy and Greece in the final, and we'll see if that actually ends up happening. Those teams are in opposite groups. But yeah, so looking forward to that. Everyone knows that Danny and I are enormous nerds, and that is why we have Loot Crate as a sponsor. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's loot, and it's in a crate, and you get it every month. It's a monthly subscription service, and you get Epic Geek and gamer gear and pop culture items for less than $20 a month. You get 6 to 8 items, usually includes a t-shirt, other licensed gear, apparel, collectibles, unique one-of-a-kind items because they work directly with these merchandisers, and they guarantee that it's at least $40 worth of gear for your $20 a month. And you can head to lootcrate.com. And enter code CAPSPACE, our usual code on the show, all one word, capitals. We talk about CAPSPACE all the time, very easy to remember. And you can save $3 on any new subscription. It's basically a friend that knows what you love, surprises you with an awesome present every month. And the other part, too, for our international listeners is they actually ship to 27 countries. So if you wanted to support the podcast and you can't because some of our other sponsors do not ship there or provide services there, that is not a problem with Loot Crate. It is more than just a subscription service. It's an entire community of fans. They have like 500,000 Twitter followers. Really just a ton of people are using this. I can't believe how big it's gotten. And everyone shares their experiences, talks about the items that they get. Each month is built around a theme, and everyone gets really excited about that month's theme and when it's going to be unveiled, which is usually right around this time of the month. Actually, I think it's going to be unveiled in the next 24 hours or so. So definitely go to that site, lootcrate.com. Enter the CAPSPACE code, and you can save $3 off of any new subscription, and you'll be glad you did. Let's get to some games. You watched a lot of this Knicks-OKC game, in which Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook basically double-handedly, is that a word, instead of single-handedly, propelled the Thunder to victory. It was 44 points for KD in 43 minutes, including the overtime. He was 12 out of 26 from the field, but hit 4 of his 7 threes and 16 of 18 from the line. Also had 14 rebounds and 5 assists. Really a ridiculous performance from him. And then Russ, 13 out of 24, was able to get to the rim pretty well, finish over Porzingis despite a couple of spectacular blocks. And then Russ, as usual, 10 assists as well. Really a spectacular performance from both of those guys.
Yeah, and of course they did have a few turnovers, but when you're running as much of the offense through those guys as they did, that's totally fine. And for me, Durant getting to the line was a huge factor in their success, at least early at various points. And also Durant hit some gargantuan shots late in the game to put it into overtime in the first place.
KD, really, those 18 free throws, not a ton of them. I mean, maybe only half of them are really plays where he's going to the basket and you feel like, all right, we need to foul him. He just gets fouled on jump shots more than just about anybody. And he can leverage that because he's so tall. You have to sell out to really get a contest on him at all. He can make shots over a contest. Whoever's guarding him is going to be shorter than he is. And then he's just kind of spindly. So there's just kind of like a lot of his arms to hit as well. And he's also just a master at drawing the contact.
There was a really good example of that. I think it was in the third quarter. It might have been in the fourth, where Lance Thomas was trailing behind Durant on a screen that was on an inbound, and Durant basically just felt his arm on him. He wasn't even in the shooting motion. Then he started the shooting motion, got three free throws, and nailed all three.
Those are the types of plays that will just kill you, because he was only 12 out of 26. If you can just not foul him too much, then he's not. I mean, he'll be efficient because he's shooting threes, but it's not going to be like something crazy that you just can't deal with, like that 44 points. And he was coming off screens. It was Lance Thomas mostly the one guarding him. I think he did about as well as could be expected, but the Knicks don't have on their roster a guy that you think of as a wing stopper at all. And Lance Thomas was a little bit overmatched, although he competed well. It's not like KD was getting a ton of wide open shots. Whether it was coming off, they love to just kind of dribble down and get a quick hitting down screen on KD. And especially when it was Robin Lopez, they'd always send him out to Steven Adams' side. And Adams sets a good screen. Robin Lopez does not have the mobility to get out on someone like KD. And so he's able to get pretty wide open on pin downs. Also, anytime he gets the rebound and dribbles down, you just have to be on him, you know, more than heels on the three-point line, maybe even a little bit a step further up, because he's just going to pull up on you. And then if you switch a big onto him, Porzingis had a little bit of success, but he also got crossed up nasty, and just KD came right down the lane for a dunk as well. So that was just another monster KD performance. He is back. He's just as good as he's ever been, really. I mean, I think the only reason he's not has quite the counting stats that he had 2 years ago is just because Russ has been there all year, and he's blossomed even more as a player himself.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, just that we're seeing a different Russ now, and that the ecosystem is going to lead to a little bit muted KD stats relative to his hilariously great MVP season.
The biggest thing that popped out to me, I only really watched like the last few minutes in the overtime. The Knicks, for most of this game until the very end, were just lighting up Oklahoma City. How were they doing that?
A lot of the margin that was created at various points in this game was actually by the short stretches that Oklahoma City played with neither Durant nor Westbrook. As Anthony Slater writes for the Oklahoman pointed out, the lineups without those two in only 5.5 minutes were outscored 16-3. And so you think about just what a 13-point cushion does. The other kind of big thing that was interesting to me in this game was the Knicks were moving the ball a lot more. What nice thing about Sportview. The Knicks passed almost 100 times more than the Thunder, which is a lot. And then it was 11-4 in hockey assists, Knicks to Thunder, even though the total assists were pretty close. So they were moving the ball more, which isn't surprising. They were getting looks, and in the part of the game when they were playing kind of a more functional offense, they were getting to the line more as well. So they were doing it that way. And importantly, they weren't turning the ball over. So you kind of piece all that together, and you can see how even with kind of less conventional talent, you can still cobble together a pretty solid offense.
And was there anyone who, you know, was a real problem for Oklahoma City? I mean, they lost Robertson, so that's not going to help. Steven Adams was back for this game. Cantor got killed against Brooklyn, obviously. Was there anything from an individual perspective or certain lineups that just didn't really work outside of those ones, just the non-Russ KD lineups?
No, I think Porzingis did pretty well. They, of course, underutilized him just like it seems like they always do. Oh, the other big one was Anthony Morrow. They're playing him with the second group, and they're playing him guarding twos, and the backup guards for the Knicks are Galloway and Jerrin Grant, and he could guard neither of those guys. So when those guys were on the floor together and that was his defensive assignment, whoever he was on was just torching him. And that's not a surprise.
So they're just like blowing right by
him.
Yeah,
Jerrin Grant, I think, got by him twice. Galloway was going to drive by him and then just pulled up for three and hit one in his face. And that's, you know, that's not a surprise. That's one of the weaknesses of Anthony Morrow. He has the strength of being one of the best catch-and-shoot guys in the league and the weakness of almost everything else.
If only my dream hybrid strain of Anthony Robertson could become a reality.
Yeah.
But that's the player that that the OKC needs, but
that's who they gave. That's who they gave up 2 first-round picks for.
In the offing, yeah. 5.5 minutes of non-KD and Russ time is not really that much.
No, it isn't.
Now maybe Donovan went away from it more earlier than he would have planned because they were getting killed so badly. But you know, the Warriors basically do the same thing. They'll play about that amount of time in the course of a normal game that's not a blowout, without any of their big three on the floor sometimes. And now they've adjusted a little more, so it's only kind of 2 minutes per half, but for a time it wasn't. I think that that's getting it down low enough to where, you know, I mean, maybe the construction without them was really bad as well. And, you know, not having... I guess the problem is just that those groups don't have anything to hang their hat on, right? Like, I mean, offensively, what are you going to... if you're that team, and then defensively, they're not like some great shakes either. I mean, at least those Warriors teams, their backup units can defend, whereas you can't necessarily say that about Oklahoma City, and they don't have like a go-to guy to score on either.
Exactly. The challenge is that their defensive talent isn't there, and so they can't do what the Warriors do sometimes, which is just turn it into a slog and basically survive those minutes. And so the Thunder defense with those groups, from what I've seen, has survived at certain points. But it can be, like, when it's problematic, especially because they don't have help defenders in that lineup. Enes Kanter, a guy that I regularly kill on this and every other podcast, is particularly weak in that facet. So if Grant or, let's say, Galloway in this game, if either one of those guys gets by a defender like Morrow, they're going to have an easy path to something, whether it be a basket or an assist or something like that. And so you kind of need an identity with that group. And that can even be outscoring the other team. You know, it can be... Isaiah Thomas obviously is far better than that now, but you know, you think of a guy who is like, well, he's just going to help your offense outscore them in those minutes. But you need something. And one of the other storylines for me in this game, he ended up having an efficient outing, so it wasn't like, oh, he was a bad, is whether in this time without Robertson, whether we see Deion Waiters change not his efficiency, but his shot selection, because there was one moment in this game where I just went crazy, where it was a transition opportunity. I think it was Durant, Westbrook, and Waiters. Westbrook was behind the play, but he was still around. And Durant passed it to Waiters, who then just pulls up for a deep two and bricks it in transition, and I pulled all my hair out.
Yeah, it's Waiters doesn't have like the highest usage rate in the world anymore. You know, I think last I checked a couple weeks ago, he was actually under 20%, but he still is good for a couple of head-scratching long twos per game. I thought the end of this game, though, was really interesting, and it surprised me that the Knicks made so many passes, and I guess they did even down the end of the game, too, because they wouldn't actually try to get their terrible ISO post up for Aaron Aflalo until there were about 10 left on the shot clock. But really, the Knicks offense for the last couple minutes of the game and then the overtime was horrible. They were lucky to even score as many points as they did. They hit like a couple of really tough Galloway three-pointers. You know, there was a couple of scramble situations that they scored off of. Porzingis was not really involved other than just one drive off of a closeout. And it was very vexing offense, especially because it wasn't like Aflalo was blowing up. He was like 5-for-18 or like 5-for-19 or something in the game. They just kept going to him. And he just kept getting stopped. It was horrendous.
It reminded me of when I was in college to watch a Ben Howland offense, especially because the guy who, when everything fell apart with 5 seconds left in my sophomore year of college, was Aaron Aflalo. And it's just like, well, why are you giving it to him? But this is an NBA team that has other guys. And so especially when you're playing with a lead, you know, and you have some offensive talent, you want to still use everyone. You want to, you know, run a cogent offense, because the easiest way to let another team in the game is just to stop yourself functionally. And it was depressing to me, because you have Porzingis, a guy that you and I have both become much higher on over the course of the year, because he's a unique offensive talent. He's a guy that you are going to have to kind of figure out how you're going to deploy him. And they basically ignored him. The only play was his creation. It was like the ball ended up with him, and he's like, hey, I can do something. And he drives and does that crazy lefty finish.
Yeah, and actually, I guess we forgot to say that Carmelo didn't play, although it's probably pretty obvious that they're going to Aflalo that much in this game. I did have a nice suit on the bench, though.
Very nice suit.
That I enjoyed. But and what they had to do then with Carmelo not playing was they still went with Porzingis at center. It was Lance Thomas and Derek Williams up front, and then Aflalo and Galloway in the backcourt. And, you know, you thought, all right, we got to do that with the, that kind of a shooter at center. Steven Adams, I thought, did a pretty darn good job on Porzingis with him being more of a traditional center. But a huge aspect, the Knicks are actually up four with about a minute left, and then they gave up an offensive rebound to Serge Ibaka. They gave up another few offensive rebounds in the overtime, and that goes back to a trend that we had noted a couple of weeks ago, that that Porzingis at center lineup, and then you, Lance Thomas and Derek Williams aren't great rebounders either, despite sort of being combo forward types. That unit does not defensive rebound well at all. Porzingis, on his box outs, he'll tend to sort of like have to turn around and face the guy and get tied up. He's not really able to separate and kind of sky over guys the way we've seen some other sort of skinnier guys do. You know, I think he almost sometimes maybe even gets too caught up in trying to box out instead of just pursuing the ball. But he also doesn't have the bounce of some of the, you know, those Tyson Chandler, KG type of guys either. So if he's going to play center, though, he's got to get better at defensive rebounding, because I think when he's at center, their rebounding defensively is in like the mid-60s percentage-wise.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And it, especially that was you noticed it more when their offense wasn't flowing too, because basically you're giving the other team outs on both ends. And the Knicks, what I keep seeing with them is there's a lot to like. Like their defensive play has been better than I ever expected. They have some players that I enjoy, and you sit there and you go, oh well, they should get a lot better with time. But the challenge with them is that they don't have the roster flexibility that, you know, if they were a, let's say like where Utah is in terms of the cap situation, that they could do. So you have to make it a little bit more ambitious. And whenever I see a team that just basically stagnates their offense when they have guys who are better than that, I always get concerned.
Yeah, the thing about playing Porzingis at center, and I thought Adams did an okay job on him, but there's this play called a pick and roll that the Knicks might actually consider using, especially against a team like Oklahoma City. I mean, they weren't making Oklahoma City rotate at all or really do much, and so with Porzingis at center, you can run a pick and pop with him, and you should be able to get either a switch or a good look, especially if you run it early, on nearly every play. And Aflalo, the other problem with him is that he's a horrendous passer, so they would throw it in on him. He's not going to draw a double team, so he's not going to be able to pass. And then on occasion, when he would get doubled, he wasn't able to find guys like Porzingis. I mean, you would think that with Porzingis' shooting, maybe if you have like a real post beast in there, that you could then like back down, draw a double, and then Porzingis can hit a shot. But, you know, nobody really on the Knicks is enough of a threat to draw two on the ball, other than if you're going to run that Porzingis pick and pop down the stretch. And that's watching the Knicks down the stretch was sort of why I was so shocked that Oklahoma City gave up as many points as they did throughout the game.
Well, their offense was more cogent the rest of the game.
All right, let's get to another really, really good game. I thought the Clippers and the Pacers. You watched more of the first half of this, and Miles Turner went off in the first half.
Yeah, when you let Miles Turner get looks, when you're not coming out on him in pick-and-pop situations or just he's just standing there situations, he's going to hit that shot pretty reliably. And while I'm excited, as you are, for that to eventually become a three, as a two, if he's hitting it reliably, that's enough.
Yeah, now he's been shooting an unsustainably good percentage on long twos. He's been shooting like 60% on those in some of these games. That's not going to happen. He did go 7-7 with, I think, four of those long twos in the first half, and then he was 0-4, all of which were long twos, and a couple of which were pretty bad shots, although he'd been kind of hitting those recently in the second half. And a big reason why is because he torched Cole Aldrich in the first half, who was not able to have the mobility to get out on him in those pick-and-pop situations. And then they just decided, all right, we'll just leave DeAndre Jordan out there for the entire second half and alleviate that problem. And he was absolutely fantastic defensively in this game.
Yeah, he's a really talented defensive player. I mean, I actually think that his defensive reputation around the, you know, the basketball Twitter and media members was actually hurt by Doc's effusive praise, because it led to a bunch of us, including myself, poking holes in that. But he's certainly a good defender. He's just not an elite defender in that group.
I agree with you. From Indiana's standpoint, they were actually much more successful in this game when they went with the two bigs. They actually started two bigs, even though the Clippers were starting with Paul Pierce at the four. And so it was Lavoie Allen and Jan Mahimi, and then they went with Turner as well. And the one period that they couldn't score, ironically enough, is when they went small. CJ Miles is just mired in a horrible slump right now, which is really a shame for him. And this was the lineup that they could not score against. Chris Paul, Pablo Prigioni, Jamal Crawford, Austin Rivers at the four, and DeAndre Jordan. And they missed 11 straight field goals and didn't score for 5 minutes and 30 seconds to start the fourth with five turnovers against that group.
Incredible.
And, you know, Rivers actually did a pretty decent job on Paul George. He can be pretty good when he's matched up one-on-one. It's when he has to rotate, when he has to not get caught over-helping, when you move the ball. That's not something that the Pacers do a ton of. That's when you can cause him to make mental mistakes. But if he's just locked in on one dude, he can do pretty well. And they even had some moments where they switched pretty well also, and Rivers was involved in that. So it was a very nice defensive game for the Clippers, especially in the second half, and that's what really enabled them to get a 10-point lead. The Pacers made a furious comeback and got within, I think they got within one a couple of times late, but never were able to get over the hump. And part of the reason for that was they just really did not execute very well late. They had a couple of inbounds down the end, especially with a chance to tie down two, where they just couldn't get the ball in bounds after two successive timeouts. It was really terrible. The Clips did a great job of denying it, but they just couldn't get it in bounds the first time, and then they threw it away trying to force it to George when Monte Ellis was open, and that was those failures in execution really hurt the Pacers late.
They did, and I don't know. I have trouble thinking about, you know, where the Pacers are going to fit in this mix, but one of the things that has been really striking to me, we haven't talked about it just because it didn't happen in the Warriors game for obvious reasons, we've seen a lot of teams elect in the last 2 days or 3 days not to foul with a very narrow time differential when they were already trailing. And it happened in this game. It happened, I think it was in an Orlando game yesterday. And it's continually shocking to me.
Yeah, this one I think was about a 4 second differential. My preferred strategy in that situation, and I think they had a timeout beforehand too, so they could have set this up, is ISO and then shoot a three as the shot clock's expiring. And if you do that, yeah, okay, if you don't draw iron, then the shot clock gets reset to where it would have expired. But if you do draw iron, you basically buy yourself another 2 or 3 seconds until they can get the rebound. And then the other thing that you do in that situation is you crash the boards like crazy because you know the other team can't fast break. They have to take a timeout. And as long as you don't commit an over-the-back or something, that actually has worked to the Clippers' advantage in this game. Jamal Crawford got the offensive rebound. I don't know if that was a specific strategy or not. And then he actually ended up committing a backcourt violation. He was on the baseline, tried to throw it to someone, and then just went all the way into the backcourt. And that was actually fortunate for Indiana, but also unfortunate because inbounding at half court, they weren't able to get the same kind of angle to inbound. And that was a big part of why they couldn't get it inbounds after that. But I thought it was presents a lot of interesting little strategy nuggets, which, you know, in the grand scheme of things may not matter, but, you know, those type of things could win you a game or two over the course of the year, and that does matter.
And the point you made on the threes is very important. Something else that I've noticed teams don't do a lot is if you're the offensive rebounding team, if you just hit the ball in the air, like if all you do is you get a finger on it and just knock it up, that'll probably buy you enough time to end the game. You don't even have to get the rebound.
Yeah, or just prevent them from getting a clean rebound.
Or just Crawford had just thrown the ball in the air as opposed to throwing it more vertical than lateral. That probably would have worked too.
Yeah, potentially so. But you can be forgiven for not thinking immediately on the fly, especially because it was like the second offensive rebound of his career. He's not really used to being in that situation.
Yeah, for me, it's more about tipping the ball as opposed to focusing on the tip instead of the catch, because that's something you can work on.
Chris Paul was unbelievable in this game. He had 26 points, mostly on jumpers. He abused Paul George a couple of times late, including getting the shot to put them up by 5, which was from the elbow, basically just a straight ISO. And Chris is really now starting to master that same James Harden move where he takes a dribble and then gathers it really late. And, you know, in past eras, this probably would have been called a trail. But basically, as he's picking the ball up, he'll take like 2 quick steps immediately to his left that is still considered part of the gather and shoot a step back. And he's now become adept at doing that going in either direction, especially when he's isolated against a big. He loves to do that move. stepping back behind the three-point line to his left. And so he got Paul George a couple of times late. And another observation is there's another miserable Monta Ellis game. This is the first year. This is supposed to be the year that might actually be where he'd be worth $11 million a year before he starts tailing off as he's gotten older, and he certainly has not been worth that so far this year.
I think I've said enough mean things about Monta Ellis or written them that I don't really need to pile on.
All right, let's move on to Orlando and Milwaukee. It was a 107-100 win for the Bucks at home. Another Orlando loss. They are really in nearly free fall at this point. This was closer than that final score indicated, though. The Orlando was within one, and there was a six-second differential, and then the Bucks actually hit a three. They went a little bit early. But it was pretty close. Monster game for Giannis. I think it was 12 out of 16 from the field. Was able to get out and transition a ton. He had a huge tip dunk late.
Yeah, that was crazy.
As well. Did pretty well defensively. Orlando, not a team that's going to beat the Bucks up at one of their big weaknesses on the defensive glass. And they held Orlando at only 44 points in the second half after giving up 56 in the first half.
If you were to think of, culprit might be too strong a word, but if you were to think of like kind of a player who disappointed in this game from Orlando, who would you say?
There are a couple. I wouldn't say that anyone had like a horrible game. Vucevic, he was 7 out of 19 with his customary two free throw attempts, you know, but he also got thrown a lot of flaming bags where he had to just jack up a long two late in the clock. There were probably about five or six of those that really hurt his efficiency. And he had a couple of moments, like he blocked Greg Monroe late on a post-up that looked good, but Monroe ultimately got the better of him, got to the foul line eight times. He had 21 points, and since Monroe never shoots basically outside of 2 feet anymore, you have to lay a lot of the blame on the center. And then also the Bucks, even who are run very few pick and rolls due to their lack of spacing, were able to get a couple on Vucevic as well. And then Aaron Gordon, he did play 37 minutes, but he was only 3 of 9, didn't get a touch on most of these offensive possessions. And really, I still think that he looks totally lost offensively, and just a guy who could really be unleashed with his athleticism if he had more shooting around him and played with a great pick and roll point guard, but not a guy who's going to create his own offense at this point. So it's good to see him playing more, and I think he could be really good, but it's going to be hard for him to succeed the way that they're playing right now.
And the Bucks out rebounded the team. Congratulations.
Yeah, it was a really interesting, because both of these teams start these combo forwards where it's Harris and Gordon for the Magic, and then it is Jabari and Giannis for the Bucks. So it was interesting to see there's a lot of switching that occurred in this game. The Bucks D is looking much better than it was early in the season. They've kind of dialed down the pressure a little bit. They're doing more switching now. That's been helping. And they're protecting Greg Monroe a little bit more as well. And Orlando, not a team that runs great pick and roll game, and that's going to really help Greg Monroe as well. Helps him look a little bit better. So that's that was part of how the Bucks were able to do well in this game. The Skiles rotation Magic 8-Ball had an interesting conclusion at the end of the game as well.
Yeah, so the lineup was, well, for a lot of the end, it was Napier, Fournier, Hezonja, Aaron Gordon, and Vucevic?
Yeah, and the thing that kills me about Skiles is, all right, I understand it, closing out with a certain guy if he's playing, like, unbelievably well. Hezonja actually had some really nice moments in the fourth quarter, kind of got them back into the game a little bit. He had a real nice game. He was, I think, 4 out of 7 for 11 points, actually got to the foul line a couple of times. You don't see too much from him. He came off screens to hit threes a couple of times, got to the basket another time. Of course, he still jacked up a couple of shots. I mean, I think his ability coming off screens was encouraging in this game, and I would like to see more from him kind of doing that, moving without the ball, giving it up quickly if the shot's not there, you know, it still is at the point where if he touches it and the play is for him, he's shooting it no matter what. But, you know, that's true for a lot of young guys. If the play is for you, you're just shooting it no matter what. And he was okay defensively. So I understand why he was in, and then they brought back Oladipo at the very end. But why on earth you would have had Shabazz Napier in there over Payton, I have no idea, because Shabazz just wasn't playing well, and he had two enormous mistakes defensively at the end.
Or even Oladipo, if you're going to get creation from guys like Fournier.
Yeah. I mean, with Fournier and Hezonja, having Oladipo at the point isn't necessarily as damaging as it would be in other circumstances, because you have more shooting on the floor. Oladipo and Payton have, you know, had their moments at times, but generally have not really worked that well together. And they went on their big run when they separated those guys in the starting lineup. And so Napier, I mentioned he made these two huge mistakes. He was guarding Jared Bayless, and the Bucks were closing with Bayless, Michael Carter-Williams, Middleton, Giannis, and Greg Monroe. And Bayless had two threes in the last 2 minutes, both of which occurred because Napier overhelped in a situation that didn't need any help at all. And then he's way too short-armed to close out even on a guy like Bayless. And Bayless basically was wide open. I mean, one play, just Chris Middleton was ISO'd at the top. This is when they were up one with a 6-second differential. Orlando was playing for the stop to try and get it back and win the game. And so Chris Middleton was ISO'd at the top, not really going anywhere on Evan Fournier. Middleton, maybe you have to help on him more if he's down in the post, but he's not going to blow by guys. It was going to lead to a contested two, very likely. And Shabazz comes off of Jared Bayless on the wing, goes all the way to the elbow to, like, kind of stick his nose in and prevent penetration. And Jared Bayless just flares to the corner, wide open. Middleton throws in the ball, and he's got a wide open corner three, and that ended the game, essentially. Especially when Orlando went for the usual quick two on the following possession with 13 seconds left, down four. But it was, and then he did the exact same thing on another play. I just didn't understand why he was in there, especially on a defensive possession late, when they're trying to deny the ball inbounds, why you wouldn't go with Payton there. And, you know, he was like 1 of 4, and he had like one assist in the game or something. Like, it wasn't like he was doing anything to deserve to still be out there.
Can I go in a little bit of a big picture minute with the Magic?
Please.
So before the season started, I had this theory with Orlando that they were going to be, actually the first week of the season as well, that they were going to be in a lot of games and they were going to lose them. And then early in the season, they were winning a lot of games, and so you were seeing that. But so now they're falling back. They're, you know, I think they're 12th right now in the East. I'm going to give you their schedule from now to the All-Star break. At Boston, hosting Boston. At the Spurs, at the Thunder, host the Clippers, host the Hawks, at the Hawks, host the Spurs.
That's bad.
Like, this could get real. And I don't think that's a bad thing for them. I think, you know, in the overall scope, if they can get one more stronger rotation player, especially considering I believe the playoffs wasn't really that realistic for them once kind of the wheat separated from the chaff in the Eastern Conference. But that could be hard to take, just considering they're already 1-9 in their last 10.
Yeah, it's tougher than they are now. 20-24, weren't they, like, 20-13 at one point, or like 19?
I think they were
13?
19-13.
Yeah, that is really a very disappointing fall, and they're now down to a negative 1.4 net rating. A lot of these East teams have come back to earth a little bit, but they are not looking great. I mean, at least it's good news for a team like the Hornets and the Heat and the Pacers, who have not been playing all that well either, and the Celtics are on a run now. So yeah, I think Orlando is really starting to look like, you know, one of these teams that now has like a 10% chance for the playoffs, and that's if they turn it around right now. I mean, I don't think they've even had like a West Coast swing yet that I recall either. So
I don't believe so either. They haven't. I don't think they played the Warriors once.
All right. I think that'll do it for today. You got anything to talk about before we go?
No, we can talk about it another day.
All right. We will be back tomorrow. Hopefully, we'll have the first of our deep dives on a team series with a guest that I'm really looking forward to. And then also, Danny and I will be continuing our series on the trade deadline previews. I think our Clippers trade deadline preview is still very green and interesting now in the context of Blake's issue. I don't suspect that he's going to get traded, but I mean, just sort of something to remember about the overall situation that they're in as a team, their cap situation, when guys are going to be free agents. There's some good information in there, and obviously on the other Pacific Division teams as well. And then also, if you missed Spurs Warriors, we had a podcast about that last night where we got really deep into that also. So that was a lot of fun to do and a great game to be at. So thanks again, Danny, for coming on. We will talk to you all next time.